Thank you so much for coming out tonight to be part of this celebration as we celebrate Black History Month with the Minnesota Vikings. My name is Leah B. Olson, and I will be your moderator tonight for this fantastic panel that we have. In the celebration of Black History Month, the Vikings have expanded their efforts to include a high school courses for students in the Twin Cities through a partnership with EverFi. The educational outreach program will be implemented for 3 years and will align with the diversity and inclusion elements in the school's curriculum. So last week, students who have participated in the course called 306 in African American History were invited to a screening of the movie Hidden Figures and participated in a conversation with Duchess Harris, who is on our panel here tonight. It went fabulous, and it was really great. The young high schoolers from Apple Valley and Eden Prairie had some wonderful questions for Duchess Harris. Tonight, we celebrate Black History Month by reflecting on the stories of our past and sharing our thoughts and ideas on how we can use our past to allow us to become together as a community. I think this is going to be an incredibly thoughtful conversation by our esteemed panel that has varied and unique perspectives on issues of social justice, civil rights, and diversity and inclusion. At this time, I would like to introduce our panel. Well, I'm going to start right here to my left. Dr. Claiborne Carson, the Stanford University historian selected by Coretta Scott King in 1985 to edit and published the writings of her late husband, Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. Carson has devoted the majority of his professional life on the study of Martin Luther King, Jr. and the movements King inspired. Please welcome Dr. Carson. Duchess Harris, who is comfortable in her home environment here, chair of the American Studies Department and author of the books Black Lives Matter, and Hidden Human Computers, the Black Women of NASA. Harris's grandmother was one of the first 11 African-American women to work at NASA and help John Glenn get into orbit. Welcome, Duchess Harris. The youngins on the panel, that her perspective will be very interesting for all of us. Niara Williams, class of 2018. McAllister's student of theater, dance, and critical theory and has performed on stages throughout the Twin Cities. Welcome. And I would also like to welcome Carl Eller, one of the Purple People Leaders and Hall of Famers. He played in the NFL from 1964 through 79. Eller was born in Winston-Salem, dealt with the issues of segregation at the time, and has many stories to share with us tonight. I would like to also mention that Justice Alan Page was going to join us tonight. Unfortunately, he has become ill, will not be able to join us, so we wish him well and a speedy recovery, and thank the rest of you for joining us tonight. So I will ask this question, and then let's just kind of go down the line and have everyone see if we can just start a conversation around sharing a little bit of your past and what you've been through to get through maybe a little diversity and some issues that would also help us move to the future. I'll start with you.
Is that a question?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, first of all, just in terms of introducing myself, I'm looking out at the audience, and how many of you are 19? Okay. When I was 19, I attended the March on Washington. So that's kind of where my activism got its start. Around the same time, I met people like Stokely Carmichael, Bob Moses, names that you might be familiar with. But they're the ones who really told me about something called the African-American freedom struggle, the Black freedom struggle. And so for me, they were the heroic figures of my life. They were the ones, my role models. They were the ones who I think still today are the people who transformed this society in various ways. And I think one way of expressing what they accomplished, and I'll just throw this out, is I think that when we refer to the Civil Rights Movement, it was that movement primarily before 1965 when the majority of humanity got basic citizenship rights. If you think about it, something was happening around the world where 20 years earlier, the majority of humanity were not citizens of the place where they happened to live. And in the United States, many of us were second-class citizens. And that movement achieved a great deal. But King's last book was called Where Do We Go From Here? It was written after that. And I think we're now in that where do we go from here moment. We still haven't answered his question. So I'd like to just throw that out as a beginning point of our discussion.
That's right. So my background is that I was born in 1969, which was the year after King was killed. I come from a Southern family. My family was originally from Virginia, but my dad had a job transfer, so when I was two, we moved to New England. And the way that that marked me was that forced busing started in Boston the year that I started kindergarten. And so I actually lived in a suburb of Boston. We were one of less than 10 black families in this town, which meant there were less than 50 black people in this town. And so when people saw us, they knew who the Harrises were. And that meant that black students from inner city Boston were bused into the town that I lived in, which meant that it started the year I was in first grade. I was the only black first grader who wasn't bused in. And so that was a complicated position to hold. The other thing that marked me in terms of civil rights was going to college during the Reagan administration and what that meant. And then before I graduated, having Bush be president. And the anti-apartheid movement and all of those things marked me to become an activist.
Excellent. Sierra? Well, I was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1997, the youngest of four children. I spent my elementary and middle school years at a public school, but when I went to high school, I went to a predominantly white, private, Catholic, college preparatory, generally upper middle class school. And those being my, I don't know, connections during that time, going to college, sort of at the advent of Black Lives Matter, was a little jarring to see people I had known for years. There were 76 girls in my graduating class. We all knew each other by name, knew each other's siblings, and it got to the point where I was defending people in Ferguson online who were rightfully angry, burning flags, someone telling me that if they're so upset, if I'm so upset, we should just leave and go back to Africa. And even after that, being at this particular institution, a predominantly white institution, it's important to be able to find your own people, black Americans and black people diasporically. And something that I've struggled with a little bit is being one of the few dancers, actors of color in my theater and dance department. And we have made some strides towards being more inclusive in being able to tell more stories with more black and brown bodies. But I think there's still some work to do. And I see a lot of my own work as an artist, as an activist, to be being able to transform people and to tell culturally specific stories and to introduce people to histories and viewpoints and understandings they may not have realized that they'd had. I was recently in a production of Medea. It's a Greek tragedy. And initially they wanted me to have really big hair, which I was sort of into, but after a while they told me that the shape of my head without it had a sort of fierce dignity, and I was like, yeah, 4C Medea, yes, yes. I think even just having particular bodies in particular spaces can open up your mind to possibilities you didn't really understand before that you thought of as impossibilities. Thank you. Carl?
I'm Carl, and my history spans pretty much all of this period, certainly going back prior to Brown versus the Board of Education, which was certainly a big legal battle and a distinguishing factor, I think, in current African American history, because it basically said that separate schools were not equal, and so that was a big breakthrough. Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court sat in on that case. And I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I was actually born in 1942, so in 1960, I graduated from high school. And a lot of the sit-ins and the civil rights movements actually had a foundation, you know, in the southern states, particularly, you know, in North Carolina. They began the sit-ins at a university called A&T University. And so as a student, probably just a few years younger than you are now, it was really, for me, a good excuse to get out of class because I really did not understand the significance of what was going on. Even though I was party to the Jim Crow era. And the Jim Crow era was, everything was separate, like blacks, whites did not integrate. And I break that down because now you use terms like diversity or ethnicity. But in my world, in those days, there was only two people. You were white or black. And if you were black, you were, like as was said earlier, you were second-class citizens. What you need to understand is being a second-class citizen means that you don't have the rights of a first-class citizen. This follows you, and it followed me, so it framed my experience. And so my experience was basically fleeing the Jim Crow South to come to Minnesota, which was a very, very different state. I won't call it a diverse state by any means, but it was certainly different in terms of living in the Jim Crow South. So there are many anecdotes that I could certainly talk about, because when I lived in that situation, it was an everyday occurrence. You just live there. Identity was suppressed, basically. And so a lot of my young adult was finding out who I was and commanding my not just my rights, but my self-respect. There's obviously a lot involved in that. There's a lot involved in these stories here, and I'm very honored to be part of this panel. So thank you,
Carl. So if we move to 2017, what would you say are the most pressing issues that African Americans are dealing with right now? Let's start with you, Dr. Carson.
Human rights. I think that civil rights, there is a distinction, and one of them is that civil rights are the rights that government says that they'll recognize and hopefully protect. And that's why we have civil rights laws. And I think that the struggle for citizenship rights was a profoundly important struggle. But I think once you get that, you realize the battle is not won. I think that's one of the things that King recognized, that you wake up the day after the Voting Rights Act is passed, and if you were poor the day before, you were poor the day after. The fundamental day-to-day life of most people did not change. And that's, again, true throughout the world. The moment you get independence from the colonizer, the day after, things haven't changed. So why haven't they changed? Well, I think one of them is that we spend a lot of our time defending the gains of the past. And a lot of the last 50 years have been spent, are we going to lose our voting rights? Is the Supreme Court going to interpret it so it goes away as Supreme Court back in the 19th century took away civil rights acts that were passed back then. But rather than simply defending the gains of the past, I think that we need to be thinking, what are the rights going forward? You know, no one to this day has really defined a right to medical care. No one today has defined a right that any government will recognize to a job, at least not in this country. All of these kinds of rights that are crucial in the 21st century are really rights that have to be imagined, and they have to be then fought for. And I think that that's why when King wrote, "Where Do We Go From Here?" he really laid out a new agenda about getting rid of poverty. That's what he was spending the last years of his life trying to do. And he was very adamant about that in a way that some of us find it really difficult to even imagine. You know, like just a few years ago, we had the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. How many of you recognize that King's last movement was an Occupy movement? He wanted to go and occupy the National Mall of the United States and stay there until change came about. That's the King I study. Mm-hmm. You know, not the King kind of left on the steps of the Washington Lincoln Memorial, giving the "I Have a Dream" speech again and again and again, but rather someone who was trying to redefine what rights meant going forward. So I think that that question that he asked is still the very relevant one. Where do we go from here? You know, how do we? And one of the things, getting back to what's been said by other people on the panel, part of that is identity. Because one of the things that I think happened is that we've spent the last 50 years trying to define who the "we" in that question is. Who are we going forward with? Other Americans, black people, you know, all of these kinds of possibilities open up about who are you going to struggle for a better future with. So I think we have today just a whole lot of questions that need to be addressed. That's why I'm so thankful for Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. because it woke us up out of this complacency and of my generation. Of saying, "Oh gosh, well, we won those battles." Mm-hmm. No, nothing in the Civil Rights Act prevents the killing, police killings that we see today. And we need to begin to address these kinds of issues about why do we still have this division between rich and poor, good schools, bad schools. You know, what is it now, 60, 70 years after Brown versus Board of Education? Does anyone really believe that education is equal for black students and white students? Basically, the way most black people get equality in the schools is to go to the white school. That's what's happened today.
What have your eyes seen at McAllister College? The question for both of you two. As far as education being on a white campus, but that does have a very liberal edge to it.
I mean, what I have seen is a struggle to have African-American students. Of course, there are lots of discussions about the representation of the entire diaspora, so students from the African continent, Caribbean students, but our enrollments for black American students are quite minimal. I've actually been here 22 years. I don't know if I've ever seen more than 7 African-American students graduate in a class, and our graduating classes are between 400 and 450. And how we recruit students, right? And so when you talk about white schools, I would say even a particular kind of school that students here are from prep schools. And we don't go into certain neighborhoods, and we don't talk to certain high schools. And I think that that's an issue. The other issue I find is, regardless who is in my class, what is in the K-12 curriculum? And so that is a new passion for me, something I've just picked up in the last few years, where I struggle with the fact that students come to my classes and have very little background whatsoever on the significant role that African Americans have played in the American narrative. As James Baldwin would say, that the American narrative is the African American narrative. And that is how it plays out in an institution like this. I mean, this school is $62,000 a year. We're ranked 23rd in U.S. News and World Report for liberal arts. And so to get on this campus, there's a certain level of privilege and access you've had to have. And in that privilege and access, the narrative that I want students to know is absent.
I agree with everything you've just said, Duchess, and something that I do often question and think about for myself and for others on this campus is the small number of Black American students. And with McAllister having a very, very noble goal of turning their students into global citizens, they tend to neglect their domestic students of color, especially in admissions. There is a very big focus on having, here's a student who's applied from a school in Ghana, excellent. Here's a student who's applied from a school in Jamaica, excellent. And it is absolutely wonderful to be able to have Black people from all over the world to be able to come to this school. But at the same time, I do very often question why I was admitted to McAllister. I had a great GPA, I had tons of extracurriculars, but there's just such a small number of children of slaves on this campus mm-hmm. that it's a little mind-boggling at times. And beyond that, just at any university, but especially a predominantly white one, there's a social distance with your peers who may not be familiar with you and who are not trying to get to know Black people like you. They'd like to know someone more international, someone more cool. I know when I first came here, I was dancing at one of the school dances, and people came up to me, and they were like, oh, you're such a great dancer, you're such a great dancer. You can't just be like, just American, where are you from, where are you from? And there's definitely a little bit of a stigma against being just Black.
Interesting. Interesting.
Well, it's really an interesting panel and a very diverse approaches here on the stage and panel today, but what I think I hear is that there are different approaches. And Niara, I think I'll just kind of start with you because I think it is very difficult to find an identity if you're trying to find that identity within a group that is particularly unclear or uncertain about their own identity. And I think this is a struggle among African Americans because I think it's when we still try to document who we are and how we are and what we are and our rightful place. And I want to say this in such a way that when we talk about we really need to understand history from the standpoint that how these worlds form and how they basically exist today. And two popular figures, obviously, a lot of people talk about W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, who were some of the first visitors to the White House. And they were discussing a protocol or some African way of life, and W.E.B. Du Bois chose the route of law, and Booker T. Washington was a landowner, like an asset. He wanted to use his assets. And so what happened was I think that African Americans interpreted this as being not having your own say-so or in other words, they wanted to use the law to correct the wrongs that had been done through W.E.B. Du Bois. And the other way was land ownership. And so people thought of land ownership as being degrading, basically. But what that is that if you own land, you have a resource, you have an asset. So it's basically having possession or ownership versus some type of equalization or through a law or something like this. That's part of our culture, and I think you've seen that fight come up through the ages. So my take and my current thing is that you have to have power, regardless of wherever you are or whatever point in time you are. And so when you're in power, you can command those things that you desire. You have more say-so in being able to do that. So where I think we're going in the future is not so much an identity specifically as black or an African-American, because I think we're going to a global identity which will identify you with individually who you are and what you do and what you stand for, where you may be rich or poor, black or white, gay or straight or any of these things, but you will begin to say, these are the values, these are the things that I stand for, these are the things that I support. And so we've talked about the education system and getting African Americans on college campuses, and I think this is part of the problem, because we, as African Americans, do not typically embrace education. So that's a dilemma. That becomes a problem. And so it pervades throughout society. This is why you have images from other people identifying you as something which you may or may not be, but you also have yourself identifying, fighting for that cultural identity that you want people to see you as. Up until then, you're sort of invisible. So that's what they want to see, is like, oh, you're like an African student, or you're something else, or you're an athlete. They carve that image of who you are. And so we fight against maybe an external image to find out or to find our own image. But the point is that we don't really get a documented image of who we are, and it changes, and we don't really command that. And so what I think for me is we will have an identity that basically says who we are, not based on color, ethnicity, or gender.
Would any of you like to respond to that?
I don't think we should just go in order. Again, but I think I disagree, but I'm not sure if I'm completely understanding. Mm-hmm. But I think that yes, identity has become more complex. You know, this is a global world. In fact, I think of Martin Luther King as one of the first theorists of globalization. He was talking about how we would be affected by these kinds of changes. And just look at this audience. I mean, this is not the audience that would have been here 50 years ago. And it's not just that there's a few black students on campus, but that you can see the change very vividly if you go into any of the large American cities. You can see that this is a multicultural world, and it's in which identities are intermixed, in the sense of you've had 50 years of identity movements, and in which identities have been defined more carefully and more assertively. So I think, of course, you're going to have that complexity. And my daughter-in-law is, let's see, Nigerian, Canadian, in terms of how she got here. And, and of course, my grandson is going to have even more complexity in his life. Mm-hmm. So all of that is true. But in this country, the most important division is still black and white. And anyone who got through the last election and doesn't see that, I mean, do you realize, just one way of expressing that, I said that in 1963, I went to the March on Washington. In 1964, there was an election. Lyndon Johnson won the vast majority of the votes. That was the last time the majority of white Americans voted for a Democrat. If only white Americans voted, every president in the last, what is it now, 50-some years, mm-hmm. would be a Republican.
Yeah.
An increasingly conservative Republican.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that division still defines American political life, despite the increasing diversity. And in fact, the only thing that explains the Democrats along that way who became president, including Barack Obama, is not that white Americans changed their minds and said, oh, now I'm ready to vote for a black person. Yeah, there were some like that. But the majority, and it wasn't even a close, of white Americans did not vote for Obama. He never got above about 44% of the vote. And in some parts of this country, he never got above 20% of the vote. So I think that we can talk about this increasing complexity of American society, and it's true, that's the reason that complexity, the way in which American society has become more diverse, explains Barack Obama. Because how does a president get elected who only got 44% of the white vote? Well, it just means that the nation has changed. Mm-hmm. And now it is possible for a Democrat to win with that basic black-white division still in place. So I think that I'm simply mentioning that to not present a real pessimistic picture of America never changes. Because, yes, people do change, and we have had a black president. But to just remind you that we shouldn't avoid the obvious, mm-hmm. that's staring us in the face, mm-hmm. that this is still a racially divided, racially unequal society. Go back and read the Kerner Report back in 1968. And it said that America is moving toward greater division, class, and race. And there's nothing that's happened in the last 50 years that has stopped that. So to me, that puts the burden on us to speak openly and honestly about that basic thing, even as we recognize that it's become incredibly more complex. You know, with all the people who would mark multiracial if they had to define themselves.
So if the conversation around race in this country is becoming even more difficult, how do we bring in other races and white allies to have a conversation that feels like we can move forward?
Well, one of the things I've been thinking about is this notion of black Americans not valuing education. And I was thinking to myself, it seems like the nation has moved toward anti-intellectualism across racial groups, right? And so when I heard you say that, I was thinking, well, I'm not sure that is a central core value of our nation at this particular moment. And I think we have gotten there because we don't value facts, right? The way that people want to be post-racial, people want to be post-facts. People don't want to acknowledge expertise. What is news is in question, right? And so I think that allyship, at least in my life, is around people who actually are pursuing thought. And that, at this particular moment, seems to be unusual, and that seems to put those of us who are pursuing anything academic or intellectual to be in a minority, regardless of our racial background. I think, however, for us to say that, you know, a Native American community or a Hmong community or a Somali community or a Black American community or a Latino community doesn't value education doesn't address the structural inequality, right? And so it speaks to the fact of what kind of access do we have? And so, you know, do we have access to the same spirit of education? Do we have the same access to teachers who embrace us or embrace our children? And if people were starting in the same space, then people might celebrate the learning experience. So I have three children of my own. They have gone to different kinds of schools because I'm that kind of mom that I've tried to embrace their learning differences. I have some class privilege, which means I've been able to have some of my children go to private schools. And I will tell you, the resources are profoundly different. Okay, so you drop my youngest off to private school, and people stand on the curb to greet him. Okay, as long as it's not 20 below. If it's above 20 below and the principal stands at the door to welcome the children, okay, that's not public education in America at all. The little kids wear their, you know, slippers in school if they want to. They are comfortable, you know, and it's not set up institutionally because certain schools are preparing children for prison. Right? If they're not preparing them for prison, they're preparing them for some kind of structural setting where they will be told to do and how to do it. And so I think if you have access to, you know, organic food and you can bring your hummus for your snack and you can, you know, play with your, you know, toy blocks, and if your educational technology is monitored in a particular way, then you celebrate education. And I'm not sure if that has anything to do with race or culture or if it has to do with parental income.
So that would be my next question in speaking about if education is the key to dealing with the disparities in the Black community, why have we struggled so heavily through all the years in educating kids of color, and is it really about economics?
Could I just invite everyone in this audience tonight, just go and search for the, there's an institute at UCLA that looks at educational inequality. One thing that you'll find is that today there a larger proportion of Black students go to predominantly Black schools today than did in 1954. Does that surprise you?
But it's true.
Just look at what is happening long after Brown versus Board of Education. And I'm not so sure if that would not be true right here in Minnesota. So I think that we need to just be realistic about the problems that we face, and they are serious. One thing about this movement toward making everyone citizens of the place where they happen to live is that that implies that you can achieve this ideal of democracy and diversity. Name me one diverse country in the world that's not having a huge amount of problems today. It's a very difficult task.
Just to speak to a little bit of my own experience with education, my maternal grandmother was born in Hanna, Louisiana, and she was in school until second grade when she had to drop out to help her family with sharecropping. And she did that for a very long time, and only within the past decade did she go back to get her GED and then her college degree. Yeah. My mother was the first person in her family to actually go to college. And she started graduate school, but she eventually had to stop to support her children and to work. And ever since I was little, I had always known that I was going to college. My mother always said it to all of her children. My father always said it to all of his children. We were going to college. My dad was a freelance musician, and so he was able to, like, when he had spare time, when he was home, he taught us fractions, sort of drilling us. My mother, She put each of her children through private college preparatory Catholic schools. And this was not easy, because at different times we were in different schools. She would have to go to Creighton Prep, she would have to go to Duchenne, she would have to go to King Science Middle School to drop off all of her children. And we all got good scholarships. We all had to apply for scholarships. My brothers did work study at their school. They were one of the few students who did work study, cleaning the floors, cleaning the tables, cleaning classrooms at their own school in order to be able to go there while paying an additional however many $100 a month. My sister did work study at our high school while having to pay about $300 a month. I was very fortunate in that I got a scholarship that did not, where I did not have to do work study, but we still paid in $100 a month. And it was very difficult. There were weeks on end where on Sunday we would make a large pot of rice and beans, and then for the rest of the week, that was just what we would be eating. My school lunch, where I was going to school, was $5 a day. We were not paying $5 a day. So my mother would give me $50 a month, $50 at the beginning of the month, and she would tell me to make sure I was able to feed myself. One of my brothers, he would go to Krispy Kreme before school every day. He would buy a dozen donuts for maybe $5, and he'd sell each one of them for a dollar at band practice. There's just a lot of effort and a lot of pain that goes into succeeding in those institutions, and it can be very lonely and very painful and a huge financial and emotional and time stress on families, and some people are just absolutely not able to do it. I was very fortunate that my mother was able to have a flexible enough work schedule that whatever pastimes, extracurriculars that me and my siblings wanted to be involved in, she would make sure that we were there on time as much as she could and supported us as much as she could. But that is absolutely not a possibility for every single family.
I would like to ask one more question, and then I'd like to open it up to all of you. You mentioned Black Lives Matter, Dr. Carson, and I'm curious to the opinion of the people on this stage. Is it, so your words about Black Lives Matter were very positive. Is it effective? Is protesting still the way of the future? Does the movement need to change, or do you still see it being an effective way to create change?
Arguing effectiveness is when you're trying to achieve something very difficult, like human rights, it's going to take a while, and it's going to take a lot of innovation. When I think of W.E.B. Du Bois, who you mentioned, I mean, just think of his life. He was born after the end of slavery, so he never saw that victory over the slave system. And he died on the eve of the March on Washington. So he never saw the victories of the civil rights struggle. And he lived into his 90s. That's kind of the nature of struggle. You can struggle all your life and be as effective as you can and be as brilliant as he was and still not gain the victory. I mean, when will the victory be? I mean, some basic human rights issues, the right to health care. When will that victory be? When you get sick, they won't ask you first for your insurance card. Now, in many areas of the world, that's not the first question to get asked when you get injured and you get taken to the hospital. It's recognized that you have a right to health care. Think of the immigration issue. I think it's a human right of anyone to live anywhere they want on Earth. That's been exercised, that human right was exercised by probably every one of you who have an immigrant person who came here and in your ancestry, they did not most likely have a visa to come here. They just came. They got on a boat and got off in Ellis Island and they came. So they were exercising their human right to follow opportunity. So why are we even talking about a wall to prevent that from happening when we know that that wall is not going to prevent it from happening? It's just going to go deeper into the violation of human rights of people to follow opportunity. So I think we have a lot of battles. I leave it to the younger generation to figure it out. Hopefully before you get to be as old as Du Bois. But look, you're going to McAllister.
Yes.
You're brilliant, obviously. She's brilliant. I have some brilliant students of my own. They're going to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And it might take 90 years. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that, to me, is the hopeful sign.
Sure. I mean, I just wanted to respond to the Black Lives Matter question, because when Ferguson started to unfold, several people said, why can't they be more like the civil rights people, right? And even though I was born at the end of civil rights, as I said, I was born in 1969, academically, I've been trained as a scholar to know quite a bit about the 60s. And so my response to that was 55% of Americans were not in favor of the strategies of Black Lives Matter. But if you go to the Pew Report, 61% of Americans were opposed to the March on Washington that you attended. And there is a woman in town by the name of Dr. Josie Johnson who was also at the March on Washington, and she says that you all were told that you needed to leave by sundown, right? And so the thought that when people were at Woolworth counters and the things that you lived through and North Carolina and A&T, that middle-class college-educated students were sitting at lunch counters and their Sunday finest and people were pouring mustard on them, we like to have revisionist history. And we like to say that it was a moment of passive resistance. Well, passive resistance wasn't so passive. And when you move into the era of Black Power, Black Power has a certain edge to it that Black Life Mattering doesn't even have. But because we're here and we're in it and we feel it, people think this is so much more. And I think to myself, what did Reconstruction feel like? And if you aren't willing to live through the arc of protest, what are you going to have to live with? And, you know, I don't want to live with less, so I'm willing to fight for more.
Right, let's open it up. I'm sure there's some great questions out here. Does anyone want to start us off? Who's our first Braves? How about one of the college students?
Right.
Youngins.
I know who you are.
Yeah.
Don't
right
make
here?
Me call
Perfect.
Now.
Yeah, we have mics that we're passing down. Here we go.
Hi, thank you guys. It's been very wonderful to listen. Like everybody's been talking about, and especially you, about studying what Dr. King did at the end of his life, specifically focusing on economic empowerment and economic inequality. What do you think are current steps to focusing on that those economic changes that really focus on human rights and the ability to access human rights? Because obviously, through legal systems, nothing's happening, or nothing good enough.
Anyone feel comfortable addressing that? Carl, do you want to talk to that?
I want to be sure I understand the question. It was like, what are we doing now to really focus on human rights and equality, economic equality, that nature? One of the things that I like to say is that the history is very, very important. And it's aggressive when we object or when we demonstrate. This is very aggressive, whether it was was very passive. I mean, the freedom rights movement was not really a passive. It was very dangerous. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you could really, you risk your life. And so there is a historical context that this is all enveloped in, because it doesn't stop or start. As Dr. Carlson said earlier, it continues, and oftentimes you don't see the results of your participation. Having gone through that, one of the things that I experienced, I went to a segregated school in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Atkins High School. It was all black students, all black teachers, principals, administrative, cooks, waiters, janitors. Everybody was black. Niara mentioned the fact of, like, not seeing other black mm-hmm. people here or other mm-hmm. black teachers here. But that passion comes from people that you can identify from. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about the economic status or stratosphere, I think, and I'm going to go back to education, is because when you don't have people that you can connect with, it becomes very difficult. That becomes a primary objective. The survival becomes more important than really the education mm-hmm. itself. So here's what I suggest is moving into those areas where there is difficulty, where there is, and it's not necessarily segregation, but we do need school teachers. We need people of color in the school. I know right now there's this thing on the news about the lack of doctors that are being imported into our country because of the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. That's an opportunity for people to move in those positions and those professions. I mean, this is how I think we combat and the status quo, and historically the status quo. And I think we have to really change some of our... We just have to make some changes, because what we've done, basically, even though we've had great success, I think a lot of people would say it's been very, very stagnant. And so that's why I feel that there is unrest here. Mm-hmm. I want to add one other thing, and that is that I'm an American. I believe America. I mean, I was born here, and I've lived here. And so I believe that what we have right now is an exercise in being American. And so I think unrest has to be with America. We had a vote, and the vote, the outcome is the result of our democracy. So if we are complaining about the results of it, then we are complaining about the system, which is America. That's what I think we're complaining about. And that's what I think you have to deal with. So we have to deal with, like, hey, how do we change it? We apply the principles and the rights and things that we have that we have currently. So that's like if you vote, that's how you get the person in office. You go to school, you get educated, that's how you get those jobs. Now yes, poverty, background, history, all of that stuff plays a part of it. Yes, I understand. I came from a poverty, mm-hmm. and as I understand, I think we're some of the fortunate few that were able to provide mm-hmm. an education for our kids. Those are small numbers, but individually they make a difference, mm-hmm. because the guys that I know, you know, they have scholarships, now it's important. Their kids are going to have a different experience mm-hmm. than they had. So, yes, that will change gradually, but I think culturally we need to embrace those things that say, hey, we demand this change by our action, mm-hmm. not just by protesting. We demand these changes because I am a PhD, or I'm a master's, or I'm a skilled technician. You know, I can afford these housings, I can feed my family, I can have those accoutrements that I desire because I can afford them. That you can't deny me that. That's a right, whether you're black or white. And I think that that's what you need to stand up to. Like, America and being an American they don't write different constitutional laws. I know there are amendments and all these kinds of things, but the thing is that the right to pursuit of happiness is for everybody. That means is that you cannot stop me from pursuing that right. And so I have to remove any objections there are to that. That's on an individual basis. We have to do that on a cultural and racial lines, too. Wherever there's an obstacle, whether it's health care, whether it's education, whether it's poverty, we have to move in that direction. In actually a military faction, I mean, we have to dedicate ourselves to say, this is important. You can't stop me from being educated, getting educated. You can't stop me from getting a good job or living where I want to do, where I want to live.
Great question. Thank you.
I would just add, though, that we have to emphasize both the individual. Yes, all of us tell our kids, as an individual, you have to do your best. You have to move ahead. But we also have to look at the structural barriers. That when I went to UCLA in the mid-1960s, I could work my way through school because the fee was $99 a semester. Mm-hmm. Check what the tuition now is. At that time, they did not charge tuition. Mm-hmm. Find out what state universities are charging what private universities used to charge. So what I did is impossible today. I couldn't do it. So all of you who have that choice today, just take it as debt that you take into adulthood. You know, you have to carry this debt for the rest of your life, which means that you can't buy a house, you can't do other things. So you can either accept that passively and say, okay, I just have to struggle harder as an individual to get ahead, or you can say that's unfair and change the system that's making you do that.
All right. Any other questions? Oh, great, right here.
I am educated, and my parents were not educated, and it was very important to me that my children be educated, which they are. But my focus was their education and for them to give back. And when I say give back, their example is of me and their father of always helping underprivileged children in various ways, whether it was education, financially, emotional support. We've taken several kids in our home and helped raise them. But my point is that now I look at that and I say, okay, I thought education was the key. I thought if I had educated children, they can make a difference in the world. And they can. But now in this day and age, I think I let them down because I didn't make them, for lack of a better term, activists. I didn't stress to them exactly what their rights were. I told them about racism, and I explained to them what was going to happen to them. But I never told them how to fight it. And so when I see kids today, how do I tell them, how do we fight the racism that we are facing even more so today than we were when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And I will say even to my children, when I would prepare my son, per se, when he turned 16, before he left the house, if you get stopped by a cop, yes, sir, no, sir, da-da-da, you know, the whole routine that we have to go through every time. Well, needless to say, my son is 25. He's been stopped, handcuffed on the side of the road twice in two different states for no reason at all. Mm-hmm. I have not prepared my son how to handle the effects of that and the anger that he has in him now. What do we do to our children? How do we prepare them for that?
I mean, I think that is an excellent comment because it addresses the fact that there are different levels of education, right? So depending on what kind of parent you are, you're concerned if your child knows calculus, right? Now, if you are a different kind of parent, you're concerned if your child knows calculus and if your child knows how to handle the police if they're stopped. Those are two different things. And so the notion of what emotional intelligence is when you add a racial factor is on a whole nother level. And so there's a new study out by a faculty member at the University of Pennsylvania about resilience. And resilience is culturally specific. And how to exist in this nation as a Black American is particular, and it's something that goes along with parenting. And if we avoid it, it's only going to show up, right? I mean, you know, if he gets pulled over at 18 and that's a surprise, that probably isn't a good thing. But often we don't know how to navigate these things because the landscape has changed drastically. When my brother started driving, there's always been police brutality, but it wasn't at the level of what I see now. And so what you have really is a different way in which we have to socialize young people to think about survival as much as learning your foreign language, doing study abroad, having critical thinking skills and good writing skills. Along with that is, how are you going to navigate all of the things that you will experience in the world and the workplace? I mean, one of the things I try to emphasize, and, you know, my kids aren't young adults yet, so I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but a constant assurance that it will be difficult. It will be difficult. And, you know, people don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear that. But to have people enter the world and not know that it's going to be difficult, I think that that's doing some harm.
I think it's an excellent question. I like your answer, Duchess. I think we have to respect the contributions of those that, and I think there are different ways to protest. And I want to think of a couple instances. One, I was involved in myself as a young kid in North Carolina. I worked, I had like my first job. I had enough money to buy a hamburger at a local drive-in. And the custom was, because it was the Jim Crow South, you had to go in the back door if you wanted to eat at this place, if you were African American or black. And so I had the money, and I knew I could afford it, and so I wanted to go into the front. This is one of my first times I was going to exercise my buying power, I suppose. But the young lady says, "We can't feed you here. We can't serve you here. We can serve you if you'll go around the back." That was a lesson I learned in my early teens, and my decision was, is that my money, you know, says I should be able to get a hamburger just like anyone else. And so that really kind of said, as long as I figured I could afford it, I could get the same service as anyone else. So I didn't purchase that hamburger. There, I just put the money back in my pocket. And I grew up in Winston-Salem, was where Krispy Kremes come from. So I'm very familiar with Krispy Kremes. But the other was, is that my mother's sister, Doretha, just passed away a couple months ago. And she was kind of the last of my mother's generation. And my grandmother was a servant for a white family who was pastors in the local church. And so she served. She served in a great way. And so did all of their children, my grandfather, and so my mother, and my aunt, being the last of these to pass away. She served valiantly. What she did on a daily basis was heroic. And we have lots of people like that. We have generations of people, of African Americans, that were told they cannot eat, they cannot go through the front door, you know, they cannot sit here on the bus, they cannot have these jobs. These are heroes. These people are heroes, and we have to understand that. Mm-hmm. That these people that lived that life where they were second-class citizens just to endure the fact that they didn't have rights. And in many cases, they feared for their lives. This is heroic. So what I'm saying to you, and I think this is what Duchess is saying too, that there are different educations, and when you were growing up that way, you were educated to do certain things and or not do certain things. But let's not take your contribution and what you're doing as not being heroic. You are a heroine for your sons, your kids. You're providing them a way, a leadership. And what you're doing is marvelous, because it takes so much to be able to be that parent, to be that guiding light, to be that role model for this kid who's going to face difficulties in an unknown world, That takes a lot of guts. So give yourself a big hand for just being a good mom.
All right. Any more questions? Oh, good. We got a couple more. Oh, yeah. It's right here, and then I'll come back here.
Thank you for this panel. I definitely, like other people in here, have views on the Black Lives Matter and the border situation and the vote that occurred in November. And I might differ on areas that you wouldn't expect that I do. But the one thing that I do want to make known and quickly mention that is evident between our emancipation as Black people and integration, we owned more businesses. We had more schools that were built by Black people. Mm-hmm. We had more banks, and we supported Black businesses and efforts. We owned more land, and we did more with the money that we made with less. My concern is that we have failed in the area of keeping the Black family together. And that is the real cornerstone of any success that you're going to have in any country, is valuing keeping that family unit together and strong. That will also perpetuate a higher percentage of people valuing going to school, being morally upright, and understanding things when it comes to civic leadership, relationships. We have really got our work cut out for us, because we do not keep the family together anymore. And it is a real problem.
Great point. Thank you. Yeah.
I hear you. I hear you. There are a lot of challenges in keeping together a nuclear family nowadays, especially in historically disenfranchised communities. One, that we can all pretty clearly name the prison industrial complex, but also financial difficulties that send people to different parts of the country, issues with mental health, abuse, addiction, and communities that very often have no other avenues, and communities that don't have access to mental health, which can really drive people apart in many ways. I think there's a lot more going into it than personal irresponsibility. I think there are many forces within this world that do not value a Black family structure. And because of that, whether or not it's purposeful, it's torn apart by those systems, by prison, by lack of screening for mental health, for lack of belief of mental health issues within the Black community.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Do you have a question right here? Yeah.
Once again, thank you, everyone. I feel as though a lot of people do not understand the current struggles of Black people in America as the struggles for human rights, and I think a lot of that has to do with the lack of education in the K-12 system. And, you know, I feel like because of that, I should be part of the education, that's something that I should do as an individual. And I was wondering, is it possible for me to do this education without sort of traumatizing myself, to go through your own histories and to relay all this information at times can be damaging to your mental health. And, you know, if that is possible, how can I do that?
You know, I love that question, because it's something that goes on college campuses now is this whole notion of the trigger warning. And if you're not in a college setting, what that basically is, if there's going to be some disturbing material, should you prepare students or not? Should you allow them to leave the classroom? So forth and so on. My area, And my students are in the room so they can say, they know this is true. I say on the first day, the entire course is a trigger. The entire course is a trigger. I cannot come in here for 28 class periods and open up with, you're going to be disturbed. From beginning to end, in every spot in the middle, you're going to be disturbed. That's why we have drop ad. If you don't think you can do it, you can find another class. Does it take a weight? Sure, it can take a weight. Is it necessary? I think it's necessary. And the reason why I think it's necessary is because I know that one of my occupational hazards is I have to show footage of lynchings and graphic material, and we have to have difficult discussions. And that doesn't mean that it doesn't have an impact on me, but the greater impact is that I am centered in my narrative, right? And I'm able to share that narrative with anyone that wants to learn that. And so what it does is when you talk about people not thinking of Black Americans having, you know, human rights, it's that I feel like it's my mission to demonstrate the humanity of a people who've been here for more than 400 years and have been struggling. And so nothing worth having doesn't have, like, some reverberation of trauma. But what I find is that we are in this particular moment because people have refused to understand. And people have chosen not to understand. And with that, you get what we have now.
I think I would add to that that it's fortunate that they're able to learn the things that they can learn in your class. Because for much of American history, you couldn't learn that in any class.
Yes. We fought for that. And, you fought for that.
And I think that part of what, when I think back of the things that I teach now, none of the things I teach I could have learned in a classroom when I was going through school. I never had a class in African American history. I never had a Black teacher. Never was exposed to the realities of American history. I got American history, but it was not. If you went back and looked at the textbook, you would not recognize it as the kind of American history that you would get in an introductory class today. Much of the education I got was in the movement. That was far ahead of what was going on in the classroom. And that's why I think that sometimes there is this sense of you can't be an activist and be good in the classroom. Du Bois was the most brilliant scholar of his day. He was a great activist. Stokely Carmichael was a philosophy major at Howard University. Bob Moses has a PhD in math. You know, all of these people managed to walk and chew gum at the same time. You know, they were able to not only balance what went on in the classroom, but that meant that they could bring something else into the classroom. Mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter is in the classroom now. I have to do a lecture on the criminal justice system. Do you think I would have done that 10 years ago? There wouldn't have been a book to go to, you know, Angela Davis was still writing some of the stuff, and Michelle Alexander was still writing her stuff. Mm-hmm. So that mixture, to me, that's real education. I think that the young people I know in Black Lives Matter are some of my best students I have. Mm-hmm. And I say that even though sometimes I kind of wonder about the tactics. Like, I was trying to get home one day and they went and blocked a bridge. Mm-hmm. I think 60 some of them got arrested. And I thought that was probably not the most effective tactic to get across your message. But those were some of my best students. And if I look back at the tactics, you know, this earlier in the discussion we were getting into whether the tactics have become more wild and mm-hmm. violent and all sure. that kind of stuff. the very first protest I was in, civil disobedience, was we were trying to get jobs in a grocery store. So we came on a Friday, 5 o'clock Friday. You know what grocery stores look like, 5 o'clock Friday? And we shut it down. Mm-hmm. Absolutely shut it down. Now, that was not nice tactics. It got the message across. That grocery store chain signed an agreement after a few months of that. Mm-hmm. And now people have jobs there. One of our targets was Bank of America. They later won an award for diversity hiring. So all of this, I think we need to understand that there is this connection between what you're learning in the classroom and what you can take out of the classroom. As far as the movements of the future, you're not going to get that vision in the classroom. You're more likely to get it out on the street.
To speak to...
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. To speak to whether or not it can incur trauma to be constantly teaching this sort of material coming from a college student's perspective, I feel like I initially came to concepts of critical theory, critical race theory, of the history of black people in the Americas and abroad, from a place of really trying to know more about myself and the world and why I was feeling a certain way in the world and to be able to cope with that in some way. And in a lot of ways, I can't quite find the word, but it's difficult to try to have to reiterate that journey over and over and over with strangers who may not necessarily care. And going back to being a student on a college campus, I feel like there are times in which I am interrupting professors, other students, conversations in the cafeteria, overhearing conversations in the hallway, conversations that I probably really should not hear, in which I need to educate people, in which they are just so grossly misinformed, or they just have such blatant lack of care, that you feel the need to step in. And after a certain point, it absolutely is exhausting. A lot of the dismissive looks are exhausting. A lot of the exasperated sighs are exhausting. Getting a reputation as being an exhausting person on campus is exhausting. And I think I am at the point where I do absolutely feel it is important for those of us who know to go out and educate, but I pick my battles. One thing that I have started doing within the past year, 2 years, I don't get in Facebook arguments anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't do it. I don't engage in those conversations. I look at it, the Lord is testing me, I say no, and I move on with my day, I move on with my life. But at the same time, there are some questions you will get in real life as well that you really don't need to answer. After the election, I had 2 white acquaintances come up to me and ask me how to speak to their family at Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. I don't know your family. If you can't speak to your family, how can I speak to your family through you? So there are definitely places in which it is appropriate for your own heart, for your own well-being, but there are just some situations that you do not need to place yourself in. That being said, if someone comes to you with genuine questions and you are in a place to answer them, absolutely do so.
I wanted to add and actually ask the question from the rest of the panel, because I have a theory that education in general is not really a complete education because it lacks the input, a diverse input into education. Sure. So you miss, and I think this is a flaw in our major universities in the United States, because, and I think I've heard it said here tonight, you get one viewpoint or a predominant viewpoint. And there's a richness here, you know, certainly in the diverse community, that would expand that, the totality and the value of the education. And, you know, and I did see the movie Hidden Figures, which was a great movie. I certainly recommend it. And these, again, were heroes that were unknown, until recently, unless you were, like, researched some or were part of the family or something. But But that's a part of history that enriches all of us, not just one segment. And I think what Jim Crow and segregation and what these doctrines do when they separate, you know, cultures, they leave out the richness of others, and therefore I think the whole culture is not what it could be. So inclusion is one of the dynamics to excellence, and so that was kind of what I wanted to say. And it sounds like what you've just said is being agreement with that this needs to be an inclusive, that you need to know who I am through your own research or through the school or through the education, you know, that needs to be part of your education.
Yeah. Maybe part of the education is having difficult discussions.
That's because, it.
You know, if you have a difficult discussion about gender roles, that can be painful.
Mm-hmm.
But it's necessary, and you have to get past it.
Absolutely. I think more people need to get comfortable with their discomfort. Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting when you bring up Hidden Figures and how many people, just say in general, but particularly to me, given my relationship to it, you know, I didn't know that story. But then they don't ask the question why they don't know the story. And so that right there says so much. And then people say to me, it will be so important to get young girls of color in STEM, which I completely value. But one of my responses to that is, well, black women have been at NASA since 1943. The story wasn't told until 2016. And so it would seem to me that women and people of color need to be everywhere. They don't just need to be in STEM. Because when you have people of color in the humanities, you transform the humanities. And so right in front of you, you see this movement from having no reflection of us in the curriculum to, you know, you actually creating the curriculum that trained my generation.
Last question before we wrap up. Did I see a hand over here? Yeah, that's so. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you again. So first of all, I do want to say that, like, I don't really know my history that well, but I'm here to learn and stuff. Lately, I've been thinking about empathy. To give it like a mild example, half my class are abroad right now, studying abroad, but I don't really know anything about that because I'm not studying abroad. But like, there's all that stress is involved, like just ranging from like breathing like just air in a different region of the world to like interacting with completely different identities and stuff. And you can't really, like they might say things and stuff, but you don't really, register or even understand that. And, like, to extrapolate that to, like, our society right now where, like, obviously Trump is president, and that's obviously, I think, a lot of it boils down to, like, a lack of empathy in the world. And I was wondering how the vibe was basically in the 60s and if there was, like how empathy was cultivated around that time. I was like, and I'm, you know, just like when I think of the 60s as well, I also think of like the hippie movement and how that's like very like, you know, lovey-dovey and everything like that. And I was wondering if that like had some interactions with the civil rights movement, if that, you know, like gave that extra push, or like, I don't know if like, so I was just curious how that vibe was in the 60s and how it could maybe like reflected here, maybe using hip-hop or like, I don't know, some other forms of, you know, expressions, I guess.
I think to raise the question of empathy, I think Martin Luther King would kind of lead you back to the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it isn't the Good Samaritan story a story about empathy? Of course, yeah, in today's secular world, if I mention the Good Samaritan story, how many people recognize it? But it's a story that you probably know in various forms, and that is when it's the question that really is one of the basic questions in human history. When does our moral compass go beyond our family, our neighborhood, and can apply to the stranger? that you have no familial obligation to this person, but somehow your empathy extends to that person. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the greatest thing about any social movement. It's interesting that we sometimes focus on people who are fighting for their rights. But always in any social movement, it's people who are fighting for the rights of someone else that makes it possible for them to win. That's what the movement about in support of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa was all about, is somehow something 10,000 miles away could garner your empathy enough that you would become involved in a movement to change that. Now, I don't think anybody in the world depends on empathy because it's a fleeting emotion, but it's an essential emotion. And I think that that's where, that to me is the heart of Black Lives Matter, is that people of my generation, we knew that police were killing innocent people. But we had just become complacent about that fact. I mean, I myself have been beat up by LA police. So I knew that reality. And yet, it took that movement of people half my age and younger who said, wake up. This is happening under your watch. This is happening with people who are your kids, who are your grandkids. And you need to care about that. And, of course, it helped that there was technology around so that you could actually empathize with someone you could see on your Facebook page dying. And if that doesn't get your empathy, quite frankly, you are morally dead. So that's my main reason for being so thankful for that movement, is that it stirred me out of a certain complacency about things that were going on.
Go ahead. I just want to say something real quick. So it's like you mentioned, like, you know, when you see videos of like all this abuse that's going on, there's at a point you become desensitized to it, right?
You don't have to, but
like when there's so much media around you all the time, and like you're obviously exposed to it so much, especially when you look at the news or when you, like, obviously it's not a constant.
I know what you're talking about. There are moments when you just reach saturation point. You know, do I need another picture of a starving child in the Sudan? And hopefully the last 100 pictures you've seen give you enough impetus to do something about it so that you don't need the 101st picture. But, you know, that is a problem, is that going back to the Good Samaritan story, it is one of human traits, is that we will walk by the stranger. Mm-hmm. We will go to the Martin Luther King celebration at a church and step over the homeless person in front. I mean, that's humanity.
That also brings up interesting questions to think about for me. If you see the 101st picture of someone being killed by the police and you're sick of like seeing that picture over and over, what are you going to do to stop people getting killed by police? If you're sick of seeing the 101st picture of a starving child, what are you going to do to keep children from starving? Or is it just wanting to be able to deny that reality, or just not wanting to face it in that moment, or just having a million and other things in your own day and in your own life, or I don't know. And it's also interesting, the question of empathy. It's something that I've had conversations about and read conversations about, and it's interesting to think about how empathy isn't always necessarily a good thing. Someone can empathize with the victims of police brutality. Someone can empathize with the police. Someone can empathize with immigrants. Someone can empathize with Donald Trump. Someone can empathize with Nordstrom. Someone could empathize with Ivanka Trump and her fashion business. Somebody could empathize with all black people, and a different person could sympathize with the alt-right, with neo-Nazis. Empathy is not always inherently a good thing. But I think there is something to be said about sort of a universal understanding of people's inherent value, and also of just a willingness to relinquish one's own power and privileges in order to equal a playing field for all living people.
What I'd like to add to that, and I just think that what you're saying is so desperately true. What I was thinking of is I think you know your purpose, and I think you know your values. I mean, not just 100 or 101, but what about the second one? If it's done once, you know it's wrong, and it should rub you the wrong way. You know right from wrong. You don't need to see a person getting shot in the back, unarmed, and all that to know that it's wrong and to develop some empathy for it. How many does it take? That's to me, that's, well, it doesn't make very much sense to me that it would take a sure, maybe it may take it to make a movement, but the fact is that when I see, and I think you mentioned, in your lectures and stuff, you were showing movies of lynchings and hangings.
Yeah.
I don't need to see two lynchings to know that it's wrong, and that it rubs me the wrong way, and that I want that to never happen again. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't move you like that, then I think you have to investigate your own internal signals. Right is right according to your own beliefs and values. That's not going to change. And you need to decide your actions based on what your values are. And people do have different values. Some people will see the same thing differently. Mm-hmm. I want to say this is how I see it. And no, this is how I, not based on public opinion or newspapers, but this is how I see it. And I think for African American people, that's basically they don't see it the way that it's seen in the popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different take on what's happening in the news. And you have to adjust your dynamics according to what your own values are. Mm-hmm. And we talked a couple times about, and part of that value is your own survival depending on where you are and what's going on outside. Mm-hmm. So you have to make decisions sometimes based on the value of your own life. What do I do now? What can I do now? What is my strength? What can I say to object or to protest because I'm getting harassed or I'm getting stopped or I'm getting abused or I'm getting a credit check or I'm getting... Mm-hmm. These things are wrong, and they rub me the same way that they're wrong, and they need to rub you regardless of what color I am. That these things are wrong, they're unjust. That's where your sense of value, I think, should be.
It occurs to me that the Martin Luther King told the Good Samaritan story when he came to Memphis to talk to the sanitation workers. Mm-hmm. And that's why he came to Memphis, and that's why he died.
Mm-hmm. Let's put our hands together for this amazing panel. Thank you so much. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming out. Thank you to the Minnesota Vikings for putting this amazing group together and the thoughts and it was bigger and better than I could have anticipated. Thank you very much for coming out. Appreciate you.
Thank you.